The Lapse of the Gods, Power, Sexuality, Publishing and Literature, an Exploratory Essay. When I wrote my earlier book-length essay, The Cuckold and the Vampires, an essay on some aspects of conservative political manipulation of art and literature, including the experimental and the conservatives' creation of conflict, I became even more intrigued by many aspects and associations of its topic and promised myself I would explore them further. I'd like now to continue that exploration with you, keeping in mind that my aim is to surprise as well as satisfy us. The previous essay often included the burden, "It is a lethal business," and there is no reason that in this one, too, we should not keep such danger in mind. I'd like to begin with D.H. Lawrence. In Cuckold, I discussed Lawrence's high hierarchical position in English literature, including for some decades at Sydney University, as a result of his being part of Dr. Leavis's great tradition, which emphasised humane ethics. I also looked at the political banning of what I believe to be Lawrence's most vital work, Lady Chatterley's Lover, ostensibly on the grounds of its sexuality, but also clearly as a result of its intense and eloquent rejection of capitalism and its thesis that capitalism was crippling and could be countered by an understanding of sexuality. In this belief, Lawrence stipulated zealously that all swearing and jokes involving sex were a puritanical attack on idealistic energy. There is great courage, of course, in taking sex seriously. Many writers realise that an important means to breaking through in their technique is to confront and delineate difficult aspects of their sexuality. It is as if this audacity removes the dead skin of acquired persona and allows them to use subjects and styles that were once out of reach. I remember once almost a decade ago when I tried to push my writing with huge effort into greater sexual candour to relax and revitalise it, one of my numerous publishers described the result as spicy. The floor sank beneath me as I realised he had no understanding of an enormous bravery I had thought he respected. As the work was to become my third Play with Knives novel, it may have been, too, that its political cutting edge was something the publisher wished to blunt by overall condescension. But there is another problem here we should consider. That problem is epitomised in the career of the remarkable English theatre critic Tenneth Tynan. Tynan created the critical environment in which Britain's new drama in the 1950s was possible, including by declaring that he could not love anybody who disliked Look Back in Anger. He was a socialist and a powerful advocate of the Brechtian theatre of East Germany. He supported Castro's revolution in Cuba, but was able to stop an execution on the spot there by throwing a brief hysterical breakdown. Again, one should aspire to such awkward revelations that discompose persona. Tynan, however, was also a sexual sadomasochist and felt a Laurentian mission to reveal and analyse his own and other problematic erotic traits. The social effect of this mission was to lessen respect for his considerable artistic influence and for his literary skill. That a person of such professional substance was prepared to risk that in order to investigate what he saw as a sexual basis of political power nevertheless seems to me worth great respect. There is also an endearing naivety about his astonishment that makes one tremble for him sometimes. He couldn't understand why the magazine Playboy refused to publish an essay he wrote about the attraction of women's panties. Playboy said their magazine's policy must always appear normal. Lawrence might have fathomed even more than Tynan, perhaps, the powerful use of the word normal here. There is one aspect of Tynan's uneasy relationship with power that seems to me particularly interesting. When I was working as a writer for the New South Wales Torture and Trauma Rehabilitation Service and in other workshops, I developed a hierarchical theory in which people who have suffered trauma lose confidence in power figures and in themselves and inhabit an insecure position in all hierarchies, alternating briefly at either the top or bottom. I thought that one solution might be in art or in sex, including sadomasochism, where there are fluxing power positions between artist and audience, or active and passive erotic partners. Their instability could then be stylized beyond repetitive social grief. In reference to stylization, it is clear from Tynan's writings about his sexual fantasies that the main charm in them for him was that the female partner be explicitly consenting and that she enjoy the experience. I don't think that this is merely self-justifying on his part, as he described consent, as her described consent has its own intrinsic eroticism. Perhaps we should look more closely later at the concept of consent in that regard. Of course, consent is a dubious concept in some feminist terms, as it can be a legal excuse for what a victim has actually experienced as a violation, and a friendly mutual agreement is usually not the subject of a later dispute. The nearer one comes to the conservatives' exercise of power, however, the more any playing with the concept of consent becomes political. The case of the spurious Swedish accusations against Julian Assange are a case in point. When I discussed in Cockle the conservative use of conflict to achieve political goals, some of my focuses were art, addiction, academy, illness and espionage, but conservative political uses of sexuality also deserve more attention. As I write this, Ghislaine, or Ghislaine as she calls it, Maxwell, has just been convicted of 5 charges of sex trafficking, and the intricacies of power and consent in her situation are worth noting. One scenario from a retired Israeli intelligence asset is that she and Epstein were not employed by Mossad, but, like her publisher father, Pergamon Press, Israeli army intelligence, and that their sexual manipulations and knowledge of the powerful were designed to gain political influence. This could be even more complex if Mossad had a different position, say manipulating Trump, and the army still favoured the Democratic Party's two-state solution. At any rate, Maxwell's brother quotes her as being convinced Epstein was murdered. In Cockold and some of my poems, including several later ones, like Death Wish Moths, one of the conflict tools conservative forces use for power is public betrayal. It fascinates me that artists in particular seem so trusting of power figures, like patrons or publishers, when bodies from such betrayals are strewn everywhere before their eyes. Or is it not trust? Is the flaw in them so reliable that the possible public betrayal is part of the seduction? Apart from Assange, whose entrapment has a literary flourish, and Maxwell Epstein, whose arrangements have the ingeniousness of fiction or her father's newspapers, one retired Russian spy observed that he never knew of any espionage service using honey traps as such, unless it were a young Israeli woman whose car broke down outside a military base, asking for help as her male colleagues cheerfully break and enter. Red Sparrow, not so much. Red Sparrow was written by a retired CIA employee, of whom all their other employees must be in emulatory awe, and perhaps the whole honey trap universe is a way of restricting sexuality within the powers of art. But there is a gigantic interaction always between the intelligence agencies and literature, and one of the destabilizing powers of art is doubt. When I was young, I once described the convoluted speech of a politician as like a spy novel if it were written by Henry James. But most James novels are about espionage on the hearth and the guilt of those who practice it, often couples. Anthony Burgess thought guilt was an aphrodisiac, but that may depend on whether the sexuality burrows in, like that of Proust, Hardy and Wolfe.